This is Dan Austin. I am at the home of Huey Red Alexander, 49 Citrus Drive, Palm Harbor, Florida. The date is Friday, November the 29th, 1991. Already we have been reminiscing about Red's growing up years in Seminole, Oklahoma. This recording is the property of the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. And Red, thank you for inviting me, if I may call you that, or Huey, whichever you prefer.
I'll answer either one of them.
And thank you for accepting the invitation to be interviewed for the Baseball Hall of Fame.
It makes me happy.
You've been a baseball scout for 54 years?
Right. This year is my 54th year to be a baseball scout.
Okay. Before we get into your career in baseball, you were born 1917.
I was born in Buffalo, Missouri, but I was a little bitty boy, maybe a year and a half or 2 years old, and my dad, Harry, went to the oil fields in Oklahoma, and of course I went along with him.
So
I'm really an Oklahoman, but I was really born in Buffalo, Missouri.
Down there by Hickory County in that area, if I remember correctly.
It's pretty close to the Lake of the Ozarks and Springfield. It's 35 miles north of Springfield.
Okay. Well, I have some relatives that were born. My dad was born in what was then called the Indian Territory. That was before statehood in 1912, I believe, and you were born just shortly right after Oklahoma became a state.
Right.
And so you're getting ready to celebrate your 75th birthday coming up here real quick, like.
I sure am.
Good. Likewise, my mother.
Good.
So anyway, 1992 is going to be a grand year, 75th birthday for two lovely people.
Good. I appreciate that.
Seminole, Oklahoma, lots of oil fields. Your dad was an oil rigger.
He was an oil worker, right?
Oil worker. And that was a tough life, Huey. I mean, it's, that kind of America, by and large, is gone.
I know one thing, Dan, it did for me. From the time I was a little bitty boy growing up in the office, and I'm not trying to brag on Seminole, Oklahoma, or Oklahoma, the Indian Territory, or whatever.
Brag all you want to.
Being raised in Seminole, Oklahoma, in those environments of the oil fields, it made me a man when I was a little boy. It really did. It made me a man. I grew up so quick. When I was 13, 14, 15 years old, I was a man.
You were streetwise.
I was streetwise. I sure was.
Would you recommend that for kids today?
No. Boy, you got to. You'd have to be so strong in mind. When I was a little boy, I saw all kinds of drugs. I saw all kinds of liquor, homemade beer. Everything was based on drinking, fighting, and working in the oil field. That's what it was.
And chasing women.
That's exactly right. And if that's those same things today, I wouldn't recommend it for children today because the environment was too bad.
Yeah.
But I remember my dad, Harry, saying to me, don't do like I do. Do like I say. Mm-hmm. And I always remember that. And I never had drugs in my life. I drank a little bit socially, some. I smoked cigarettes. But I never once ever thought about taking drugs or anything like that. I never once ever thought about that.
In some ways, you and I grew up the same way because a lot of times my mom would tell me to go down to the Doodlebug beer joint or something and find Dad, bring him home.
Right. My mama used to do the same thing with me.
And I remember he always said he dropped out of high school. He was a smart man.
But my dad was too, but he dropped out at the end of the fourth year, fourth grade.
And he said, don't you do as I do. I want you to get that education.
That's what Harry used to say to me.
And you called your dad Harry.
Always called him Harry. Never called him Dad. Never called him Father. Always called him Harry. And it was a peculiar situation of other people. Other people would be around, and I'd say something to Harry, and I'd say, Harry, what do you think about this, or whatever. And they'd say, you call your dad Harry? I kept calling him by his first name ever since I could talk. And why I started it, I have no idea.
And he called you Bill.
And he called me Bill. He didn't like the name that my mama gave me, Hugh.
Did he ever tell his wife that?
He sure did. He used to say to her, May, my mother's name, May, M-A-E, why did you name that tough little boy Hugh? That's not a very good name for a tough little boy like him.
Well, maybe you had to grow up tough to stand maybe a few catcalls.
Boy, it was a tough life. It was a tough life.
But so you really lived outside town?
I always lived out in the country. You know, back in those days, if you were a family and you worked for an oil company, if you were a family, you could get a company house. Oil companies, the big oil companies, furnished company houses. They were kind of a prefab house, like a mobile home, but they just put them together. They come in sections. If you were single, you had to live in the bunkhouse. And when I was a little boy, I used to always take my little shoeshine kit, my little cherub, and I'd put it on the front porch of the bunkhouse. And as soon as I'd get home from school when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I'd shine all the shoes, because the doors were never locked in the bunkhouse. Mm-hmm. I'd go to every little room, and I'd get all the shoes, and I'd take them out on the porch, and I'd shine them. And when the oil field workers would come in on the truck about 5:30 or 6, there would be all their shoes, all shine, and I would get a nickel. And some oil field workers would say, "Hey, you little so-and-so, I didn't tell you to shine my shoes. I shined them anyway." "Well, I'm not going to pay." I said, "Okay, that's all right." But most of them wouldn't pay me.
That's right.
So I'd make myself, you know, 50, 60, 70 cents, or $1, $1.50, $2. One of the funny things, I had two brothers and a sister, and my middle brother and my little sister, they could really sing. They really could. My whole family was...
Well, they sing down at the local church?
Well, they sang everywhere. But all my family could sing and play instruments, except me. All I could do was play sports. But anyway, I would take my little sister and my little brother, especially on Saturday night or Friday night, I'd go up at the bunkhouse before all the workers would go to town. And we would sing. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't sing very good, but I'd try a little bit. But those two kids could really sing. And when the oil field workers would throw the money out in the yard, I was the collector of the money. I remember one time in particular, and we could make $2 or $3, mm-hmm. you know, singing. They had my brother and sister, so we'd divide up the money. So I remember one time one of the workers threw a $20 bill out in the yard. And when I picked it up, I thought it was a dollar bill, but it was a $20 bill. So I put it in the hip pocket of my little overalls. I was about 9 years old, I guess, or maybe 10. And we get home, and Mama said, "Did you get any money?" I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Okay, let's get the money out on the table." So I pulled all the money out, about $2 or something, or maybe less than $3. And my little sister said, "Mama, you better look in Huey's back pocket, because I think he's got some money back there." My mother looked in my back pocket. She said, "Where'd you get that $20 bill?" I said, "Somebody threw it out in the yard for us."
So as a kid, you were early recognized with a tremendous amount of athletic ability. I guess your dad spotted this, or he bound determined that you were going to be an athlete?
That was always on his mind from the time I was a little bitty boy. You know, I told you earlier, not on the tape, but he taught me to be a boxer when I was a little boy, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old. And then he'd play ball with me every day, and we'd play football, and we'd play basketball. We'd do everything, because he thought the sun rose and set in Little Bell. And he used to tell people, "He's the best athlete I have ever seen." My dad was a good athlete. I mean, he was a ball player. He didn't play professional baseball, but he played first base, and he managed quite a few of the oil field teams, and they had a good team. And I was the bad boy. And I just grew up, and he didn't push me that hard, like a lot of fathers push their sons so hard to be an athlete. But I guess when you break it down, I've talked to different doctors and psychologists and people, and they say, "Well, what it all came down to, you were a born athlete the day you were born." Mm-hmm. Talking about you, because I could play any sport, I don't care what it was, I could excel in every sport, football, basketball, baseball, track, everything. And Harry pushed me as hard as he could without hurting me.
And then back off?
And he would back off then. You know, you're going to teach a boy, and you're going to play so much. You know, he can't play 20 hours a day. But Harry would always play with me, and then he would always arrange for me to be the bat boy and practice. I know when I was a little boy, and he was the manager. On Saturday, I had me a little baseball team. I was about 12 years old, but I had my own little team because I had the equipment. Because Harry would let me borrow the equipment, you know, the catching equipment and the balls and the bats and things like that. And we'd go over across the tracks, we had to walk a long ways, and play the black boys. And we were all friendly. we'd in the baseball season, we'd play them every Saturday. Mm-hmm. And we'd play them all day long. And then we'd have to walk home barefoot and all that. And when the basketball season would, or the football season would start, we'd play them in football on Saturday and Sunday. And the basketball, we'd play them on Saturday and Sunday. And whatever sport, because we could play those kids because they like to play. And I could furnish the equipment. And we could excel and beat those black kids in baseball, football, but not basketball. We didn't have a chance in basketball. That's how good
they were. Lightning fast.
That's how good they were way back there. I'm talking about 60 years ago. Yeah. That's how good they were in basketball. Well, now they're good in all sports. But we played them every Saturday and Sunday.
Every Saturday. All day long.
All
Sunday
day long. And then
sun up to sundown.
And we never had any trouble with those kids. We never had any fights. They just, and the black people would come out and watch us play, you know, and boy, they'd cheer. And I remember one year my dad was managing one of the summer pro teams. And the ballpark was over across the tracks in the black part of town. Mm-hmm. And my dad said to me, "Bill, you retrieve all the baseballs. We got to have the baseballs back." So I went to all the little black kids and said, "Now, we can't play baseball on Saturday and Sunday if we don't get those foul balls back to my dad." Yeah. Well, those little kids would go chase the balls down, and I'd be right there with them, the white boy there. And we'd get the ball, we'd get them right back in the game. So they didn't steal the balls.
No. They wanted that game to go on.
They wanted that game to go on so we could play on Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
It's just that simple.
And time you became a teenager, your dad had an offer, and that is to pack you to town to play all these sports.
Yeah, when I was 15 years old, I came home one day in August from playing ball or going swimming or whatever I was doing. And Harry was sitting in the house, and there was three gentlemen sitting there, Dr. Chambers, who was a full-blooded Indian doctor in Seminole, Dr. Jones, who was a doctor, and Mr. Woosencraft, who owned the Rexall Drugstore. And I knew Dr. Chambers and Mr. Woosencraft. I didn't know Dr. Jones, and how he introduced me to him. And he said, "Bill, these people want you to come to town." I was 15 years old, but I weighed about 170 pounds.
You were about the biggest kid in the class.
Right. They said, Harry said, "They want you to come to town, and they'll put you up in the fire station with a little cot up there. And they'll get you a job or doing something so you can play football, basketball, baseball, and run on the track team." And I never forget, I said to Harry, "Does that mean?" He said, "What do you think about that?" I said, "Does that mean I got to leave you and Mama and Henry and Claude and Edith?" He said, "Yeah, sure does." I said, "Well, that's not real easy to do," or whatever words I said, a 15-year-old boy. He said, "Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to town, and I want you to show all those people in the city what a great athlete you are." I said, "That's good enough for me, Harry." So come September the 1st or the last week in August, I go to town. Mama packed me a little suitcase or a little bag. And I go to town, they're tattoo firemen, and they put me upstairs, and there was a little cot. And then they gave me a job cleaning up a theater around the corner on Main Street for $1 a night. And I have to clean the whole theater up myself, Dan. 11:30 at night, it'd take me to 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, clean that theater up, and then I'd run back over to the fire station and run upstairs and fall in bed, go to sleep. At 7 o'clock, those two firemen get me up and said, "Get your fanny to school.
Off school.
So I played all the sports, and then I played softball with two teams in the summertime, played baseball in the semi-pro team. First thing you know, I was making $30-$40 a week.
But you kept up the boxing, too.
And I kept up the boxing, and you want me to tell this story?
Oh, being on the first card of the Friday night boxing match.
I had really learned to box good, but when I get to school, I weighed about 178 pounds, close to 180. And now I'm 16 years old, and I go to the boxing promoter who had a professional boxing card every Friday night, and he would import boxers in from all over the country. I remember one time Max Barr came in there with an exhibition and fought on his card. So I went to him one day, and I said, he owned a little restaurant. I said, "Nick, how about me boxing on your card every Friday night?" He said, "Oh, no, you can't do that, Red." He said, "You're going to high school and playing all the sport." I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do with you. This might sound like I'm a con artist, but I'm not, but I was streetwise back in those days." So I told him, I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do with you, Nick. I'll fight the preliminary bout every Friday night, 3 rounds, and I'll take on all comers. You pick my opponent out of those oil field workers." And that was right down his alley. He liked that. Because he's going to get some publicity out of it. So anyway, he said, "Okay, that's what we'll do." So he advertised in the paper and on the billboards that Red Alexander would take on all comers. Well, those oil field workers were lined up at 6 o'clock in the evening, 20 or 30 of them, so mm-hmm. they could go up there and try to whip that little young boy up there. Well, they had two chances slamming them because they were barroom fighters, uh-huh. but I could box, and I was a tough kid to begin with. But anyway, so I did that for a year and a half. Every Friday night I was there, but I got to remember, I was collecting $10 every bout under the table, so to speak. That meant that Roy and Floyd, my two buddies, the three of us could eat for a week or a lot longer than that on a $10.
You bet.
So I did that for a year and a half, and finally the last bout I had, Roy and Floyd are standing outside the ring, and I'm up in the corner, and all at once one of them said, "Huey, Red, get out of the ring. Get out of the ring." And I said, "What are you talking about?" "Get out of the ring." I said, "What's the matter?" They said, "Look over in the other corner. Who's coming in that corner? You're going to get killed tonight." And I looked, I turned around, looked over in the other corner, and the big guy just got in the ring in the corner. And it was the largest man I had ever seen in my life at that time. I had never seen anybody that big. And I said to myself, "Oh my God, what's going to happen now?" Anyway, they introduced him as my opponent. 285 pounds, and I weighed 100, probably 180. I weighed about 105 pounds, so I said, "Well, I'm going to do it. Although the thing I got to try to do is stay away from that big man for three rounds. What I got to do." So anyway, that's it. When the match was over, I collected my $10 and I told the promoter. I said, "That's the last fight, no more." He saw us a minute. I said, "If you're going to bring those big guys in, I'm overmatched."
You're overmatched. Question: when you got your fist taped up, you said something about putting a couple little whittled little sticks there to keep your hands from getting broken.
Well, I went out to a tree and I cut a little limb, you know, by the side of my finger, and I whittled them down about 3 inches long. And when they taped my hands mm-hmm. back in the restroom before the bout, I would put those two sticks in my hand so I could tighten my fists up, and that way I could keep from breaking my fingers and my knuckles. Plus the fact I could hit a lot harder. It's kind of like putting a roll of dime.
Well, I tell you what, I'm looking at you. Roll up your fist for me, will you?
It's pretty big.
That is a big fist.
It's pretty big.
I mean, you know, it dwarfs mine. So you know what, even today I wouldn't take you on.
You know, one of the stories I tell is the day I got my hand cut off on December the 6th, 1937, and just kidding people sometimes, they'll ask me what happened, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. I said, the day I lost my hand, I lost 5 pounds in weight.
Yeah,
my hands were almost big.
Huey, you went into baseball. You played in the minor leagues for a couple of years. Did spectacular up in... let me just mention a few things here, and then we're going to get into, baseball itself and that part of it that you have excelled in scouting. You were center fielder. You were fast and strong. You were on the all-star teams in both minor league seasons in Fargo, Moorhead in the Northern League, I think it was called, in 1936. You batted .348, had 28 home runs and 102 ribbies.
That's awful close. I'm sure you got your record, but that's pretty...
And then in 1937, you played in Springfield in the Mid-Atlantic League. I guess that's Springfield, Mass.
Springfield, Ohio.
Springfield, Ohio, okay. And later that year, you went up at the end of the season to the Cleveland Indians.
Yeah, the first year I signed, I was in the 11th grade in school, and I was the captain of all the sports. But I forsaked my senior year in high school to play sports, to sign with the Cleveland Indians. The day I signed with them in 35.
Who signed you?
Cy Slapnicka, the great scout for the Cleveland Indians.
Cy
Slapnicka, Slapnicka. The next year after he signed me, he was made the general manager of the Cleveland Indians. So I wanted to go baseball. I had a chance to go to all the colleges and play football and baseball, Stanford University, Notre Dame, you name them. I had chances to go to all those schools. But I love baseball so much, I wanted to have a career in baseball. And when I got an opportunity to sign, I signed. And then I went to school that winter, that fall and winter. But I didn't participate in sports. And I could probably show you in the headlines of the newspaper where it says, "Red Alexander asked to quit football." And then Red Alexander quits football. and I did it for a purpose. I said, I'm going to pursue baseball, and I think I can play in the big leagues, and I think I can play up there pretty quick, you know, with the right environment. But in the deal, Cy Slapnicker said to me, if you will sign with me, I'll give you $250 bonus to help you go to school this fall, and I'll take you to spring training this coming spring with the Cleveland Indians in New Orleans, which was unheard of. I'm 18 years old. I said, okay. So we did that, and then the next spring, then I quit school in January in my senior year so I could go to spring training in February. And then that fall came around after I played a year of pro ball, and I went back to school one semester so I could graduate from high school. So I went to spring training, and I was lost in spring training. I was an 18-year-old boy with grown men on the Cleveland Indians. But they sent me to Fargo, North Dakota. I'd never been that far away from home before, and I had a tremendous year. And you're right on there. I played every ball game that year in Fargo, and I had a big year. And Cy Slapnicker came up to me at the end of the year. I was making $200 a month, which was a lot of money, of the fact that most players in the minor leagues made $75 and $100 a month. But Slapnicker, in order to sign me, gave me a $250 bonus, plus he paid me $200 a month, which was a lot of money.
Yeah, man.
And then the next spring, I go back to spring training with the Cleveland Indians in New Orleans again in 37.
Oh, that's where they had spring training in New Orleans?
In New Orleans. And then he said, we're going to send you to Springfield, Ohio. I said, fine. But in the meantime, in spring training of 37 in New Orleans, Tom Hendricks is dressing right next to me, the great outfielder with the Yankees later on.
Tommy Hendricks.
And he had played the year before at Masson, Ohio, in the Ohio State League. And he said to me one day, I'm going to get my free agency from the Cleveland Indians. And I said, how are you going to get it? He said, well, they violated my contract, and I know they did, and I'm going to appeal. I've already appealed to Judge Landis for my free agency. And in about a 10 days or a 2 weeks period or somewhere in there, Tom Hendricks was declared a free agent from the Cleveland Indians.
That's the first time it ever happened in Major League Baseball.
Right. And he signed then a few days later with the Yankees, and later on became a real good player with the Yankees. So about a week after he was made a free agent, or 5, 6, 7, 8 days, I was notified, like today, to be in the office of the New Orleans Baseball Park to see Mr. Slapnicker before the practice opened that morning. So I go up there in my uniform, and Cy Slapnicker was sitting behind the desk, and Larry Gilbert, who was the manager and owner of the New Orleans club. And Cy Slapnicker said to me, Huey, or he always called me Huey, are you thinking about doing the same thing that Tom Hendricks did? I said, oh, no, who, not me. I said, Mr. Slapp, I always called him Mr. Slapp. I said, Mr. Slapp, I'll never forget last summer when I was in Fargo, North Dakota, and you came up there in the last week of the season, and you called me up in your room, and you said, you're one of the best ball players I've ever seen, and you're going to play ball in the big leagues, and you're going to play that real quick because you've got too much ability. And to reward you, awards it with that effect, he reached his pocket and he started counting out money on the bed. And he counted, and he counted, and he counted. And I'm counting along with him. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you know, he's up to $600. And he stopped. And he said, that's yours. I said, you just counted out $600. He said, that's right. I said, why are you going to give me the $600? He said, because you're a fine boy and you're a great baseball player. I'm going to reward you with $600. I want you to take some of this money and go home and give it to your mom and daddy when it's saved. Well, that's okay. So he gave this out of his kindness of his heart. He gave me $600, right? So that day in New Orleans in the ballpark, he said, are you thinking about doing the same thing that Tom Hendricks did? This is why I say, Dan, that fate has a part in your life somewhere. Mm-hmm. Fate has a part somewhere. So I said, no, I would not do that. I said, you've been too nice to me, Mr. Slapp, and I would not do that. I said, I was not raised that way. He said, oh, you're a fine boy. And he reached in the drawer of the desk, and he pulled out a big roll of bills, not a roll, but just a stack of bills with a rubber band around them, and he pushed them over to me. And he said, put that in your pocket. And I looked at it, and I said, what's that for? And he said, because you're a fine boy. Later on, I knew what he was doing.
That's right.
Because I could have become a free agent.
Yeah, you know, could have done the same thing as Hendricks did.
So he said, there's $1,000 there. You put that in your pocket, you go get your cashier's check tomorrow at the bank or sometime and send it home to your mom and dad. That's okay. He said, now I want you to sign this agreement get it all typed up in this agreement. If and when I'm called to the Cleveland Indian Baseball Club, I get $1,000 more money. So he gives me a copy, he kept a copy, and I put it in my wallet. I'm sent to Springfield, Ohio. I played 81 games in Springfield, Ohio, if you look up the record, I'm going to do it now. I hit about 344, but I hit 31 home runs in 81 ball games and drove in 89 runs. And I get a call from Cleveland to report to the Cleveland Indians. That was in early August or somewhere in there. I report to Cleveland. And I was with Cleveland the rest of the year, but I only went to bat 11 times. I was an extra outfielder, so on and so forth. But I'd been at Cleveland about a week or so, and I know